My name's Larry Van Dusen. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I want to start out by thanking your committee for the opportunity and the honor and the pleasure it has turned out to have a chance to come down here and be part of your weekend and also have a chance to share with you as part of that weekend. I was, like it was just read, we come here to share our experience, our strength, and our hope. And when I think about that, what experiences are they talking about? What is it that we brought into these rooms with us? And, of course, we brought in our past and all the stuff that took place there. And we had an experience where that got changed, and then we have the experiences to today. And my sponsor explained that one time as he was talking to a fella. He says, in our program, what we have is what we share with somebody is we share what happened and what we do. We don't tell you what to do or this is what you ought to do. We share with one another what it is that we have done. And it's worked for us or it didn't work for us. And we offer it to those that want to have it. And if you want to use it, then go out and use it. It comes free. There's no strings attached to it. And I think of where our, we talk about our strength. Where in the world does strength come from? And as I look at us, as we come together, I look at myself, it seems like our strength comes from our weaknesses. From all that garbage and stuff that took place in our life that somehow we were allowed to survive through, and I use that term survive because it's like that wasn't my doing, it was just it was allowed to happen, and I got through it, and I got a new chance at life. It's like being in weightlifting. Now I've been in the football business for over 30-some years in college, and I've been in the weight rooms and things like that. And I'm looking at one of my weight classes that come in. And I'm sitting there one day watching them as they first come in, and I say, being in this waiting room is kind of like being in AA sometimes. See, I got some students and people that come into the room, they're there, but being there doesn't make them stronger. You can stand right next to weights and have it rubbing against you, and it doesn't make you stronger. And then you can go out, and you can get a book and a magazine, and you can get all kinds of self-knowledge, but that doesn't make you stronger. You can know about it, but you haven't done anything yet. And then you can get the costumes, the uniforms, and everything else, and you can look good, see? And you can come in there, but that doesn't make you stronger. And then if you don't want to really pump weight, what you can do is now you can go out and get some of that steroids and stuff like that. And then you can start to look the part without having to do the action. And but you see, there's some side effects. There's payoff and stuff like that. And like with the ladies, when they use it, sometimes they those are male hormones, and all of a sudden they get facial hair. That's the kind of lady I like to be with, so somebody that shaves more often than I do. That's tough. And with the guys, you can start to look the part. They talk about the steroids. They'll give you a bigger breast, and it has some side effects. You look real good with your clothes on. But you get big breasts and small testes and acne on your body. And the only thing I can say is, hey, if you're making it, at least keep the lights off so they can't see it, for crying out loud. See? So you can get into it. There's an artificial way. But it's not real. And you got to keep doing it if you're going to stay that way. And I see you just, that's kind of like the program in here. See? If I just come in here, that's attendance. Right now we are attending. We're at. That's a position. I've attended a lot of things in my life. That doesn't mean that I learned anything. Just meant I was there. And I can maybe look the part and talk the part, but doesn't mean I lived the part. That comes in later. The comparison is, if I come in that weight room long enough and hang around people that do the things that they need to do to get stronger, maybe it becomes attractive to me. Maybe I would like to be that way. And so I go over in a corner someplace and I pick up one weight and I'm just going to do one arm curls. Well, that's not a total program. That'll make one arm stronger, but the rest of my body doesn't get stronger. And if I come into a program like this and I only use one step, that's about what I'm going to get out of that. See, the book tells us, the half measures avail me nothing. If I do 6 out of 12, I get 0, not 50%. And you got to go through some pain. I always tell my class, if you really worked out tomorrow and you touch your muscles, you don't have to know what they are. It's just that they hurt. And that tells your body's telling you you're improving it. You may not like what it has to say to you, but that's the way it is. And they talk in our program, sometimes we go through emotional pain and a lot of pain in here before we get better. So we go through a weakness so that we can get stronger. And then the question is, what am I going to do with my strength? Am I just going to keep it to myself? or am I going to try to pass that on to somebody else and say, you too are not feeling well, that you're kind of down, that your life is in trouble. If you do this, then maybe all of a sudden your life can change too. So you become the instructor, for crying out loud. You pass it on. And so from my strength was started from my weakness. And where did my hope come today? Where did your hope come from today? My hope today is from my failures of yesterday. I've lived the life of the drunk. I've lived the tragedy. I've lived all this stuff that we share with one another. I'm going to share some of the events of drunkenness. Everybody's got their own events. The thing that we have in common is the cause of the events, not the events. And so being fired and being divorced and being in jail and mental wards and all, that's not necessarily a requirement to be here. But it's the sadness that takes place in our life. And so I've had the sadness, I've had the tragedy, I've had the sickness, and out of that today I can tell you there's hope. Because for some reason right now, this moment, right here, this day, we have survived up to now. And the question is, what are we going to do with it now? And what we're saying here at this conference, every speaker's come up, we're saying that you can have a better life. My life is better. It's been better since the day I quit drinking. And it's up to this moment, it's been a beautiful thing. It's had some ups and some downs. That's what life's about. Life's an adventure. And what adventure doesn't have some good stuff and some other stuff? That's what makes it an adventure, for crying out loud. And life's going to go on that way because it's been going on that way since time began. And we're not going to change that. The question is, will I change me to fit into that? And this program allows us to do that. That we can reach out and we can get up in a morning like this and we can suck that air in. And our life is different today and there's hope. There's hope to live and to achieve whatever it is that's going to be out there today. No big accomplishments, just being an okay person today. I spent a lot of years not being okay. And so our experience, our strength, and our hope has been passed on ever since this thing started. I think back when Scotty and Linda started off, they were our leadoff hitters, so to speak. Our friend here from Australia with his baseball hat. You know, I was thinking in those kind of terms. The world of athletics is my world. So I think and have examples along there. So they got us started off real good. And old Gene came along. He's up here talking about drinking on Madison Street and Crystal Lake. Hell, I've been in those places. And I'm reminded, you know, that the dates and the events change, but the dates and the names change, but the events stay the same. Gene had trouble in those areas. I had trouble in those areas. The difference was our name and our date. See, but it was still the same kind of trouble. And it's amazing, we're both here in the same room at the same time. We traveled different paths, but we ended up in the same place and the same cause. And so all of a sudden there's three on, and in that family session you had Saturday morning, I want to tell you something, those guys came up here and they did a grand slammer. You know, when you had little Jonathan and little Jimmy and Linda and Sarah and Rob and John, I want to tell you something, that was a powerful meeting. You know, if my heart couldn't have been affected by that, then it's either too hard or I don't have one. See, you want to look at the damage we've done or can do? And hear it from the ones that suffered. We say, oh, they're too young to know. You know, like the little baby in the back of the room. If there's chaos in that family, that little baby will learn to crawl underneath the bed. It can't even talk, but it can tell you there's something wrong. So we underestimate, you know, what's taking place in our life. And so that was a beautiful session, moving session. And then we got the bases cleared, so we got to start up the next inning, and along comes our friends from Australia, from Down Under, and they did a good job in telling us, you know what, this problem's everywhere. It's not just here, it's everywhere. Wherever booze is, drugs is, there it is. And then booze and drugs has no prejudice. It didn't care who you are, where you came from, what your background is, how smart you are, how rich you are, what your color, it didn't care. So why should recovery care? If I can keep an open mind about getting drunk and doing all that stuff, why can't I keep an open mind in rooms like this and learn from everybody? If you'll share your pain with me, I understand pain. You know, you may have hit your hand with a hammer and I hit mine with an axe, but the pain is the same. Your instrument might have been different. The timing might have been a little different. But when you share your life with me and you tell me you hurt and your life came apart because of these habits, I identify. I have never heard anyone that I couldn't identify with. I don't care what your background is. I mean, I like what you look like, what you dress, where you came from. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is you went round for round against booze or drugs, and your life came apart, and so did I, and so did everybody in here for one way or another. I can learn from people like that. I learned one thing. You know, I wasn't a very smart student. You know, I'm one of those C+ students if I work hard. And I almost flunked out many times. One thing I found out when I started a new path of trying to survive through education, that as a C student, I always wanted to work with somebody who was an A. I'm not working with another C student, for crying out loud. How's that help me? Okay. And, you know, so I sponsored with the guys with our Cleveland Browns and the offensive linemen. And and I'm thinking in my mind, if I was a rookie trying to break into that league and I want to learn how pass block, I'm not going to learn from another rookie. I want to know who all pro is. That's the guy I'm going to watch. I'm going to learn from that. And I find the same thing is true in here. You know, rookies can hang with rookies, and that's good, because I did that too. But if I'm going to learn, I got to be with somebody that knows more about it than I do. And then I'm going to kind of hang around there until I can learn what they learn, and then I'm going to just keep branching and branching and branching and keep growing and growing and growing. And we'll keep growing. Like you say, we're either working our way or going our way from a drink, or we're working back towards it. I don't want to retread. I don't want to go back treading myself. You know, you can only tread water so long out here. Either you're working away from that drink or working back towards that drink. And sometimes, you know, that ocean of booze out there, and I start to tread water, if I quit treading, I'm going to sink. And it'll just eat me up right away. And I don't want to do that. So somehow I got to keep advancing, keep moving towards the goal, whatever that goal is, sobriety and dying sober. Hey, that's not a bad goal. A lot of people in my life have done that and showed how to do that. And so all of a sudden we've got those people going, and we got our institutions. Ray and John talked about that stuff. And any of us has been involved know what the service and love that goes with that. That's a beautiful way to go. And then all of a sudden we get into last night, and Peggy comes on, and we got a dynamite meeting, and the electricity and the excitement that was taking place in this room last night. See, some of us don't even realize the power that's in a room like this. We won't know that until we've left here and gone down the road someplace and wherever into our next event, whatever that is. And all of a sudden we will find help from ways that we didn't even know that we got touched. It's an amazing thing. If I pay attention, it's amazing what I can learn. So I come and I'm at the meeting. I become involved with what takes place in the meetings. And someplace along the line, if I'll give time enough time, all of a sudden I'll start to live it to one degree or another. But being human, I can't keep that always up, so I need to come back and keep getting refreshed, getting a new source of energy. So I hang real close to it. And so that was a beautiful. Now, Gene says this is a winding down. I don't know about the rest of you. I'm not wound down yet. I've been known to get wound up a few times, but I'm not wound down very often. So it's my turn. That's all. It's just my turn. Everybody gets a turn. Now, whether it's up here in front of you, or whether it's in that hallway out there, or out by the pool, or maybe it's driving home, or the midnight call, or the coffee at the coffee shop, or the guy outside the meeting, I don't know when your turn or my turn's coming next. But I want to be available when the turn comes. And then when we get that opportunity, I want to do the best job I can, because I don't want to shortchange this program. I don't want to shortchange sobriety. I don't want to shortchange God as I understand. All those things that came into my life to allow me to be right here this moment now with the people in my life and the feelings that I have, not to give your best would be to cheat the whole doggone thing. And I cheated life so much that I don't want to do that anymore. Now, I will fall short because I'm human. And I can't be at a peak all the time. But I can give you the best I got. If the best I got's 80%, you're going to get 80%. You're not getting 40. See? Because I can't be 100% all the time. And that's just the way it is. There's a lady in our area when I first got into Ohio, she'd be talking to the girls. And you have a new girl at a meeting, and she'd say to them, if somebody comes up to talk to you, you ask them three questions. And the first thing you do is you put your hand out in their sternum so they don't get too close. Okay? And you look them in the eye and you say, when did you have your last drink or drug? You don't ask them when did they come into the program, how long they've been around. There's a lot of ways of answering that. Some people have a way of totaling time, see? Okay? They were drunk yesterday, but they had 7 years. You know, I don't understand that. You know, to me, once you drink, you're gone. You're out. I quit. I'm off the team. Now, I can come back, but when I come back, it says I had the last drink. So she made that real clear, see? She wanted her girls to have some qualification to who they're talking to. Let's not be talking to, you know, a D or an F. And then she'd say, you ask them, what's their home group? And they couldn't mention their home group. And then you ask them, who's your sponsor? If they don't have a sponsor, she'd say to them, don't talk to them. Go find somebody that can answer those three questions. And for the new person, that was a good place to start from. It was a good qualification. My last drink was November 11, 1975. That's 10 days, 4 months, and 17 years ago. It just happened to cross my mind. It's the most important date in my life. Without that date, a non-drinking or using whatever your combination was, if I don't have that date, then the chances are I'm not going to have other dates. I've had several birthdays since then. There's been some marriage, there's been some graduations, there's been some beautiful, beautiful other dates in my life. But without it, I don't have those. And I have a sponsor today. As soon as I found out what a sponsor was, and that was early on, I got one. Now my first sponsor died a year ago about this time. The day he was buried, the fellow that was with me, local old-timer, I asked Eddie to be my sponsor, and he agreed to that until we have to bury him or something else happens. He's got over 40-some years in the program. So since I found out what one was, I didn't get in a situation where I was smart enough not to need one. I don't know what's coming down the pike tomorrow. And I may have to call, and I have to. And I try to keep in communication with him at least once a week. And we see each other more than that sometimes. But I have that connection. I have a person in my life that's committed to me that says to me, I can tell them anything. And that's as far as it'll go. I've got at least one confidant. I have more than that, but I have at least one. Because he and I made a commitment to one another. And so I have one of those, and I have Berea Men's as my home group today, and it's been that way for the last 13 years since they got started, but I always have had a home group since I knew what a home group was. What is a home group? When I used to stand up and say, here's a roster, I didn't know what that meant. I knew that I wasn't giving you my name, address, and phone number, because this is anonymous, right? And I didn't want to do that to a bunch of strangers. When I found out what a home group was by going to a meeting, and that was the topic of discussion, I found out that, you know, you make a commitment to something, you go there, and then those people get to know you, you get to know them, and when you walk in, they can say, hey, Daryl, how you doing? Oh, Daryl says, oh, I'm doing real good, and you know he's lying. You know that, see? And in our rooms, my sponsor always told me that we care enough to address that. Now, how you address it, some people are comical, some are very direct, some are crude, I don't care, but we're talking from one heart to another. Daryl, how are you really doing on the inside? I've had people that have knocked on my door, have called my house, we didn't see you, you know, you didn't make a comment, you know, what's going on? They cared enough to care, and not only did they care enough to care, they cared enough to do something about it. In our rooms, we're talking life and death there, we're not talking fun and games. So when we start to get kind of messed up, what we sometimes turn to is tragedy and sickness. And once we've gone out and started again, there's all kinds of hell going to break loose. Like the guy said, I would rather say something to you before you do that, rather than visit you at the hospital, say I could see it coming and said nothing. You don't do me a favor doing that. That's not the way I understand this thing works. And so all of a sudden, I have those in my life now that I understand what they are. And I needed those things because there was a lot of the stuff that took place in my life. You see, I wasn't an alcoholic until after I got sober. And then I found out what an alcoholic was. You see, you can't be something you don't know what it is. Oh, you can have it. See, you can have cancer before you become a cancer patient. That's usually the way that works. Say, I'm going to get the illness, the disease, the malady, the alcoholism. I look at the ISM, illness, sickness, malady. That's what it says in the big book. I didn't know what malady was, by the way. I don't have great word power. I thought it said m'lady. I didn't know that. I mean, I always liked ladies, but I didn't know what a m'lady was, see. And I looked it up, and it says sickness and illness. So I just look at the ISM. It didn't say alcoholism. It says alcoholism. It means it's going to be there. I had the illness before I became one. See, I didn't know that. You get the sickness, then you are one. You have diabetes, you become a diabetic. You have bad heart, you become a heart patient. You have cancer, then you are a cancer patient. You get the illness, then you lose one. Well, if you do something about it, that's something else. And I had to get sober to find out that I fit the description. And the description that I refer to is when I was guided, you know, through the treatment and the knowledge and all that stuff they give us about what the problem is. They told me I was addicted to the liquid drug alcohol. That's how the term they use, liquid drug alcohol. I'm no different than a junkie on the street. We didn't have different varieties. If you're one, then you can be the other. I was addicted to the liquid drug alcohol. When I put it in my system, it controlled me. I didn't control it. We've heard that term control in here several times. And in page 21, when it talks about a real alcoholic, it says, you know, we lose control of the alcohol once we take the first drink. What it really says, there's a word missing in there. We lose the control of the consumption. Consumption, to me, means the amount. When I start to drink, I can't control the amount that I'm going to drink. And I fit that description, and I have since I was a teenager. I also fit the other description in Dr. Silkworth talks about some of us that once we take that first drink, one of the reasons we can't control the consumption is because we get a phenomenon of craving. We want to have more. That's our allergy. And you know what? I fit that description. I fit that description today. I take a drink, I want to have more. I take a drink of coffee, I want to have more. I take the first bite of something, you can look at me, you know I want to have more. See, when I was smoking, I would light up, I wanted to have more. See, I have the same problem today, and I remind myself of that, and if I don't, my wife will. especially the eating part, because that tells me that nothing's changed in my system. See, I've got the illness that'll never go away. It doesn't change just because I stopped drinking. And so I look at these other things. I have a lady that has an office right across from mine. She has a little basket, and lately she's had chocolate hearts in her basket, left over from Valentine's Day or something. What do I care where it came from? when Joni's in the office, I'll go over and say, I'd like to have some chocolate and take two. What I really do is wait for Joni to leave her office, and I go in and I take a handful, and then as I unwrap them, they have a lot of color, I turn them to the neutral side, and then I throw them in the bottom of my basket, and then I put paper over them. Nobody knows, I just snuck the chocolate. Now I'm hungry and I have to go to lunch. Okay? It just made me hungry. I wanted to have more. My only point is that I look at myself, and if I were to say, hey, I've been sober blank time, now I can go drink like other people. I've heard hundreds and hundreds of stories. I didn't learn how to control. My system doesn't allow me to control. Whatever that is, mine's broken, lost, or destroyed. And I haven't heard that it ever comes back. And I believe that. So why should I go make a comeback against something that whipped me at my peak? It whipped me when I was a teenager. You know, I had blackouts, accidents, stuff like that. I can see that today. I had the warning signs, as they say, but the book says we're too young, we don't pay any attention to that. Shake it off. I can shake off a lot of stuff. As a matter of fact, when you're hurting so damn bad, shaking it off is kind of showing how a man you are. You overcome that pain. Go to class, you're hungover, and you play that role. Done that hundreds of times. You know, just got to gut it out. That shows you how kind of a man you are, even though you're drunk. Or that was my thinking. So I look back on that, and I got those examples in my life, that when I take that drink, I get that phenomenal craving. I want to have more. When I have more, I can't control the consumption. When I can't control the consumption, I break out in drunkenness. And when I break out in drunkenness, I do drunken things. Now, my things may be similar to yours or different than yours. But if you got drunk and did things and I got drunk and did things, the thing we have in common is we got drunk. The cause is the same. The answer is the same. They told me if you don't drink, you don't have to worry about that. And I've been trying not to drink ever since. I'm a non-drinking alcoholic. I don't know what label or term one wants to put on themselves. I've had no trouble with that term since the day I found out, because I had been called, or I called myself a lot of things before that. And being an alcoholic did not offend me. You know, I'm a dry drunk, but I'm not dried up, I'll tell you that. You know, and I'm a sober lush, and I have the disease of alcoholism, and I'm addicted to it, and all that stuff. I don't care how it's explained. All I know is I fit the description, and I am one. Now that I know the problem, what's the answer? That's the thing that I never knew. After going from teenagers to 20s to 30s, after getting my props in order, like the big book says, where the actors, the directors, and I can get married and I can have children and I can, that doesn't make me a husband or a father, by the way, that's just a process. And then I can get a house and then I can get a job and I got a couple of cars, and I'll tell you something, my props look pretty good at times to me. How you doing, Larry? And I can show you all of that. But that just gives me a place to hide, you see. I'm kind of hiding in there someplace, not knowing where it is I'm going, but I'm in a hurry to get there. See? And I jump from job to job. It amazes me how often us drunks can stagger and fall forward and still, like the cat, land on their feet and progress for a while. For a while. And then all of a sudden, bam, it clips you and down you go. See? I never knew how important alcohol was getting to me. Getting for me. It became more important than the wife, more important than the kids, more important than the job. It became more important than anything else in life. And then when it was just me and the bottle, it all of a sudden it turned on me. The big setup. See? And I never knew that until after I got sober. I didn't know who it was that was doing me in. It was booze and me, not them. But as long as I can progress through life blaming somebody else, then I don't have to look at me. It's real simple. And I progress through life, dashing from one to a place to another place. I never stay in place more than 4 years. I was in Chicago, and Gene mentioned that. I flashed back to that job, that situation. That's where I got to where I couldn't control it, messing up too much, making a fool out of myself in front of a lot of people. And I don't like that. I don't like having to get up, look at my wife to see how I'm doing. I don't like having to drive at work trying to make up lies on things I don't even know that I did. I heard a guy in our program say, never talk to somebody who knows more about what you did last night than you do. And I understood that. I didn't understand it then, but I understand it today. And as I would do that, I would be going to work. Like I say, I would be making up lies in case somebody asked me what happened, because I couldn't remember what it was. And so the way you handle a problem like that is to leave. So I made one of those geographical changes, and I took a job in Ohio, and within a month I make a total fool out of myself at a big convention, and my boss and I were driving back, and I knew I had to say something, and I said, you know, the other night, he said, yeah, I heard about that, except I said, I'm never going to drink again. And he said, I never thought you had a drinking problem. He must have misunderstood me. I didn't say I had a drinking problem. I said I wasn't going to drink. That's two different things. See, to have a drinking problem, you have to acknowledge that. I wouldn't acknowledge that. You know, I was just not going to drink because it was an image thing. It was embarrassing. I couldn't let that stuff happen. And I was the guy in charge of telling other people not to drink. So I ought to be able to do that. A man should be able to do that, see? The problem is, I wasn't a man. I didn't know that. I just always pretended to be one. I always wanted to be one. Don't know if I am today. I think I'm closer today than I ever been before. But I don't know if I'm there yet, because I'm not sure what one is. I know some, it seems. But I don't know if I am one. And so I quit drinking for 3.5 years without any knowledge of AA, alcoholism, Alcoholics Anonymous, nothing. And then I switched jobs after 3 years. And where I was back there when I first stopped, there was a lot of chaos in life. Mike and I were just talking about it. We had one of those riots when people got killed on campus and stuff back in 70. And there was a lot of stuff going down, but I didn't drink. I didn't change a whole lot of other things in my life, but I took drunkenness out for a while. A doctor told me when I was in treatment that's the most dangerous thing that ever happened to me, was to not drink for a while and think that my way was going to work. He wanted to remind me when he told me that I was in the hospital being treated for alcoholism. I was in pajamas. He said, your way of not drinking did not work. And I realized later on that my way of drinking did not work. So I don't know how to not drink, and I don't know how to drink. That doesn't leave you a whole lot. Okay. But I didn't know that at the time. I left there and I went up to Wisconsin, Madison, Wisconsin. My most big-time job and all that stuff, and things seemed to be rolling real good for Larry. And in 6 months, with a new set of people, a new set of circumstances and atmosphere, and I'm violating some personal things, sober. I don't have to be drunk to make a fool out of myself, by the way. And the next day, violate some principles of life. And the next thing I know, I'm out with one of my working friends, and we're at one of the local hotspots, and he's out dancing and squeak-talking, and he had a drink in his hand smaller than this, say half the size, sitting on that table. I'm in the wrong place, the wrong time, wrong attitude, and I reached over and I took a sip of his drink. And a sip is important to know. It was so small I couldn't sneak a lot in the first place. He'd allow to catch me, see? And I don't know why I did that. It's unimportant. The big book says there'll be times when we'll do something like that. We don't have a reason. We just do it. Especially when you don't have a spiritual program. I took a sip of his drink. I may have done it twice. I'm not sure anymore. I think I did. And you know what it did to me? It made me thirsty. I wanted to have more. I can't have more because you guys know me as a non-drinker, so I have to leave. And I stop at the liquor store and I get something to drink and I'm drunk that night. Drunk that night, blackout, X-rated stuff, all immediately. I went right back to the same condition that I was in 3.5 years before that in New York. Now I'm in Madison, Wisconsin, and I reached for the same thing that I reached for in New York, and it gave me the same thing. It gave me drunkenness. It gave me all the stuff, and my life from that moment on just disintegrated. I had a friend in our area say one time, after a period of not drinking, and you take a drink again, it's like lighting the fuse, like Michael, lighting the fuse to the time bomb. But you just don't know how long the fuse is. How long does it take to blow up? It took him 2 weeks. It took me one night. I had a shorter fuse. And from that moment on, I never got my life back in order. I got into that bottle, and as soon as I got drinking and the drunkenness, and all kinds of events, you know, car wrecks, all that stuff. In fact, I'm reminded when I come to Disneyland, when I had been picked up for a DWI there, and the cops had taken me down and all that stuff, and I told the boss a day or so later, you know, I got picked up, and I was going to hit the papers, and he says, you know, what are you going to do about it? I said, well, I just take my punishment, etc. I brought the family here to Disneyland, and I got I made a long distance call to the chief of police of this little town. They said, give him a call in a few days. And he changed that charge. He let me off of that deal. And I'm down on this street over here someplace on a pay phone, and by the time I got back to the motel, I had stopped in and started drinking, and I was drunk when I got here. That's how I reacted to somebody doing me a favor. I felt so bad about that drunkenness and being caught and maybe having the publicity. I felt so terrible about that. When I found out that I got out of it, I celebrated and I'm drunk before I get back to the motel with the wife and the kids. That's my response. When I had the double hit and run, and I don't remember it being in a blackout, and I'm down there at the jailhouse with a lawyer and talking to the cops, and I don't remember that happening. All I remember was that after all that got settled, that I had more fear of driving, but I still drank. It didn't stop me from drinking. When you got that kind of pressure and fear and all that, my reaction is to drink more. It just makes it more scary, that's all, until the alcohol does what it's supposed to do and it takes away the fear. And it does a job, and it works. So I'm up there, and my job gets rid of me in 1.5 years. They brought me in and fire it, and I don't react well to that. I react by drinking more, and then the wife of 15 years after episode, in and out of all the stuff that goes in there. And she says, if you ever do it again, and she's referring to my drinking, I got drunk right in my own house sneaking a few drinks one day. I misjudged the dosage, you see. I couldn't control the consumption. I took a sip to sneak a drink, and I wanted to have more, and I had more, and I got too much, and I passed out in my house, and she walks in, and I'm on the family room couch, and she sees that, and it was the last stamp. It was the last straw. Everybody's got a breaking point. You Al-Anons know. Everybody's got a breaking point. And that was hers. That was enough. And that deputy came over from that judge, and I never met the deputy, and I never met the judge, and they said, get out of your house, you got to do that. And I say, I'm not going. See? And I'm drinking, and you're hurting me, and I'm getting angry, and when you hurt, I got to hurt back, and they leave, and I get the shotgun out of the car. And the strange thing about that is I don't even hunt. I don't know nothing about that stuff. That was someplace when it looked like, I must have seen a cowboy movie or something, and I'm playing the role, and I have to have one. Now I got the shotgun, I'm in the house, I'm threatening my wife. She's doing that to me, you're going to die, all that ugly stuff, there's 3 kids there. And they take off, and I'm sitting there with my bottle, and I got a lamp I never liked, and I'm blowing out a hole in the ceiling and tearing a place apart. And I'm trying to create fear in somebody else. I'm thankful today that nobody responded to that. I don't know if you're sitting in your neighborhood and some guy's blowing his house away next door. What do you do, walk over and, hey, can I come in? What are you doing? I don't do that. I'm not doing that. Nobody called anybody. You know, the SWAT squad wasn't there that day. They came later and all that stuff. And I left. I wasn't allowed there unless there's two cops there. And I went to the liquor store and I got my bottles and I went to my hideout and you always have to have a backup, a place to go. I had somebody who would take me in and hide me away from life because life was screwing me over. And I can drink and destroy myself. My gut and my body comes apart. I got the shakes. We went through the divorce and all that ugly stuff I don't have time for. I ended up at the end of 75, I'm in an apartment by myself. I have to wake up in the morning like he said, I got to have the drink to start the day because it stops the sickness, you see. I've got the sickness. I'm in the bathroom. I'm in there turning myself inside out. Little yellow and green and red pieces are coming out because there's nothing there. And I just tearing my insides apart. I got the shakes and my skin's yellow. And I've got a bottle to wash it down to make it stop. I know how to stop the sickness. I don't understand that it causes the sickness. And that's the way I got to start my day. And then once that stops, I can walk out. I'm sweating like a hog. I'm sitting down there. I look like a Buddha for crying out loud. And I got my bottle. I'm sitting there and I'm not going anywhere. And you see, booze has got a job to do. It's got to stop the mind from working. You see, if my mind starts to race ahead, I don't have any future. I don't know what's wrong. I don't know what's going on, where I'm going. Then I get suicidal thoughts and stuff like that. I don't deal with that well. I drink, make it stop working. I don't want to pass out, black out, do it. Just make it stop working. And then all of a sudden it kick in reverse, and I think all the people that did me over, and I could start with God and parents and homicidal thinking. I'm looking at a hit list and all that stuff, and I don't deal well with that, and I pick up the bottle and make it stop working. Just put it in neutral, for crying out loud. Like going out in the car, stick that key in, get it started, put it in park. The motor's running, but I'm not going anywhere. See? And then the fears and things that a lot of us can identify with, the fears of sound, for crying out loud. Being in that apartment, you know, and the day has started and the telephone rings. You know how dangerous that can be to a person like me? Judas, preach, the heart goes like that, and the phone's ringing, and what do they want, and your mind just races and races. Scared of sound, scared of a phone, for crying out loud. I don't experience that so much today. I lived in an apartment right next to the entrance of the building. People came and go, and I'd be sitting out here. I wonder who it is. I wonder if they're going to stop. I wonder what they want. You know, what do they know? See, people knew more about me than what I did. See, and when you have that, you know, did they catch me up? Did they catch up with? And that kind of fear. I tell you something. I can take one position in life, and whether it's a bathroom or a car seat or a bed, I can take just one of those, and I can put my mind back to what that used to be like being in bed. And wanting to go to sleep, wanting to take and cancel life out. And I'm in bed, I'm 250-some pounds, you know, my whole world has been in a world of athletics, and I'm in bed and I'm scared, I got the blanket up over my head, blanket up over my head, I got a little hole I can breathe out of, and I'm hiding from life. And I, like I said, I'm sweating like a hog. I'm all drunk up, and maybe I'm sick. You know, maybe I have a little sand basket that I would keep. Used to be my kid. I keep it by the bed, so when I got sick, I could just roll over the bed and hit the bucket, for crying out loud. And then I might dirty the bed, or I might wet the bed, and if I went to sleep, the nightmares are worse than being awake. And I just take that one position, just that one position, and say, Larry, would you like to go back to that again? My answer today is no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to live like that. Hell, I already lived like that. I don't have to do that again to find out what that's like. I've already done that. You said I don't have to do that anymore. Here's a way. And I like to follow that way. And so I can just take one of those incidents, and if I just dwell on that for a few minutes, bam, right now, it tells me who I am. It tells me what I am, what the problem is. And you folks told me what to do about it. And I've been trying to do that ever since, so I don't have to be like that anymore. And that's the where I was. You know, I gave alcohol, I gave drink and everything I had. I gave it my reputation, I gave it my job, I gave it my wife, I gave it my kids, I gave it my physical health, mental health. I was in a mental ward and all that stuff like that. I gave it everything I had. I gave my soul to drinking and booze. And I never realized that. And that's where I was on November 11th, 1975. When a guy came by, after a series of events, a little daughter, a 12-year-old daughter, asked him to come over and visit Daddy on that weekend, and I couldn't wait to get her home on Sunday. And when I left her, I realized that I had not been a father. I failed as a father. I wanted her, but I couldn't keep her because I had this other thing, this sickness. I had to hide my drinking and hide my sickness and pretend. I was pretending to be a daddy. I wasn't one. I just pretended. And when I came back there, I realized that I wasn't, and the self-hate set in on me. It's one thing to blame you, but now I'm blaming me. And that had just been working towards that. That just culminated it right there. And then I had a person come by, and they brought me a newspaper. And in the newspaper was one of your local people, by the way, the first black pitcher in Major League Baseball. His picture was in the paper. I recognized the picture. I read the article, talked about his life being destroyed by booze and how it was better. It had a boxed-in section for a guy like me, highlighting, saying something like, if you've got a problem, call this number. I don't get the paper. She doesn't stop by. It was just that day. She was there. The paper was there. The story was there. And the number was there for a guy like me. And the faintest idea, who else saw that? Next thing I know, I'm calling the number. I couldn't tell you why this morning. They said, sounds like you got a problem. I don't know what problem they're talking about, but it sounds like I got a problem. And they said, call somebody local. And I met another fellow who had been a Major League Baseball pitcher at a golf outing one time. I remember his name and his fame and his celebrity and all that stuff. And the guy introduced him as, this is Ryan. He's the director of an alcohol rehabilitation center. He never mentioned that other stuff. I just remembered that. And 3 years later, I needed to know him, where he was, and how to get a hold of him, even though I had never thought about him for 3 years. The seed had been planted. He took his turn with me and never knew it. And all of a sudden, I needed him, and I made a phone call, and I don't know why. They sent that guy up to see me on November 11th. He took me to that hospital. They did some questioning, and they said, Larry, we'd like to put you in our treatment facility. And I look back, you talk about a surrender, giving up, chickening out, bellying up. I don't care what the term is, but I was done. I was finished. I had no answer. I didn't know what was wrong. They knew, and they had an answer for it. I went through detox, and that became the start, only the start of my sobriety. Everybody's got a beginning. You know, I had a start of drunkenness and drinking, and hopefully that's come to an end, and all of a sudden I had a start to sobriety. And that's where I found out who I was and what I was, what the problem was, and what to do about it. And so they shared that with us, and when I got time to leave there, they said, Larry, there's 5 things you should do every day. Write them down on a piece of paper, and before you go to bed at night, you check to see if you did that. Now you get to pick the 5. What is it you're going to do? You got to have discipline in your life. So I put down, read a big book. Read the 24-hour book. Read the 12 and 12. Somebody give me a copy of the New Testament. Read the good book. And pray or exercise, whatever it was. Just as long as I did those. And I wrote those down. And that started me into a pattern, into a habit of doing things on a daily basis that I do to this day. Now, some of the 5 have changed, but I'm still in that pattern. And then they gave me that schedule and said, get out to meetings. And within 6 months of being outside and things happening, I was guided back to Ohio. I started making some amends mending some fences, as Dr. Bob would say in his story. A friend that I saw on one weekend went to Ohio the next weekend. He saw a former boss of mine. The boss had a job opening. I never thought I was out of coaching. I never thought I'd be back in it again. I was trying to get a job in a state prison in Southern Illinois. And this neutral friend carried my story to a former boss who had an opening. And they said, well, you know, Larry had some troubles. They said, yeah, and they talked about that, but he seems to be okay today. And they checked that out. They invited me down. I interviewed, and the next thing I know, they offered me a job. And I've been there now for over 17 years. And I got down there and I said to my boss in a short time, I says, Lee, you know, there's something missing in my life. I got to get out to the meetings. He said, Larry, you do whatever you have to do. And I called that central office and I got that meeting guide and I started to go to meetings. Now, I can't tell you how many meetings to go to. I can only tell you that when I go to meetings, something happens in my life. Something happens to me. Since I started to go to meetings, the world has just, I like to say, world was on a dimmer switch and it just keeps getting brighter. Some people say the world gets narrow. It has not gotten narrower for me. I want to tell you something. That thing has opened up. The streetlights have come on and it's just an endless street out there to travel. Now, I've changed some habits to allow me to be out there in that street, and like it says, we want to trudge the road to happy destiny. It didn't say we skipped it, hopped it, or danced it, for crying out loud. It said we trudge it, and sometimes it's a little uphill, and sometimes it's a little downhill, and sometimes it's a little rough, and it's, you know, that's the story of life. But if I don't take a drink, and I stay close to this program, I got a chance to stay in the middle of that road, the middle of that path. And since doing that, there's been all kinds of marvelous things that have taken place in my life. By coming to the meetings, and I look at a meeting, I say, what makes up a meeting, for heaven's sakes? And I see it, there's sections to it, like a game. You've got the beginning part of the meeting. That part where we come in a little early, and we have a chance to visit and talk and get ready. See, I don't know when it is I'm going to hear what it is I'm going to need. So if I get there early, maybe Daryl gives it to me, Gene, or whoever. Then I go into the meeting, wherever the meat of the meeting is, and then it's over, and at our place we have comments, and after the comments we get the coffee, and we get the visiting, and we're talking, and maybe go out and have ice cream, and I might get home at midnight or 1 or 2 o'clock. I can stretch that thing out for a long period of time, and it may have been the last sentence, the last person I saw was the one that gave me the help. If I left too early, I wouldn't have got it. If I got there too late, I wouldn't have got it. If maybe I lost my attention during a meeting, I'm one of these people, I like to sit in different places. I don't have a master seat for Larry. I bounce and I sit every different place. I never want to sit the same place twice. It helps me to concentrate. I have a lack of concentration sometimes. Now, I try to sit up here. If I'm up here where Doug is and you fall off that seat, John, I'm going to try not to look. I didn't say I didn't want to look. I said I'm going to try not to look. When you knock that chair over and pop that balloon, I'm going to try not to jump and not to respond. I want to zero in on you because I don't know what the rest of you are doing, but the guy up here, the lady up here, that's the one that's helping me. I don't know about you guys. So fall off your chairs and fall on your faces, but I want to hear what they got to say. And then afterwards I can look at you and I can decide who I want to learn from. So that's what I try to do. And I try to do that every place that I go. And so all of a sudden I got involved with a meeting. And like every men's group, I'll tell people, you're looking for a short meeting, don't come here. It's not going to be a short meeting. So you can lead for a half hour, 40 minutes, and we'll comment for 40. And there will be people there still after 11 o'clock talking about what took place. Now if you don't like that, go someplace else. Don't come in here and complain about what we do. That's our group conscience. We have an active group. I've been fortunate since the time I got into sobriety. I've been with people that were active. You know, we were active drunks. I was an active drunk. I did a lot of stuff in my life. And when I come into sobriety, I want a lot of stuff in sobriety. So I'm an active sobriety person and get involved in doing a lot of things. And this program allows for that. And so as we get in here and we get involved and I find out stuff about, you know, home groups and sponsors and retreats and Serenity Hall and Stella Maris and jails and prisons and after visiting all that stuff, you know, when I come away from there, we were talking about yesterday, when I come away from there, I have been helped. I had a fellow in my life been to prison 4 times, 2 when I met him, 2 after I met him. I'd visit with Eddie down there and I'd say, Eddie, boy, you're sure helping me today. He said, Larry, what are you talking about? He's got his orange jumpsuit on with his numbers. I said, you know, I'm not a fancy dresser, but I got clothes better than that. I don't know what you're eating here. I mean, I worked in the jails. I had a little idea. I said, I don't know what you're eating here, but I got better at home. And I don't know what you're sleeping on or who you're sleeping with, but I got better at home. And the one thing that's in common, as we looked around the room, there's Eddie sitting there looking tough, because you know when you're in that setting, you've got to be tough. If you're not tough, people take advantage of it. You ever look at the visitors? Visitors come in, they got to look tough. The guards are around their hill. The guards got to be tough, and they're working with tough guys. The kids come in, they got to look tough. Hell, they brought pets in, they'd probably look tough. I said, Eddie, I got better friends than that today. When I left there, Eddie helped me. When I leave the halfway house, I got two fresh ones last week. One's a mentally retarded, and he's in a halfway house, and another guy, he's just kind of bouncing around like a yo-yo, and they helped me. Because you know what? I don't want to trade. I'm going to offer you what's been offered to me, and it's been proven by time and experience. I can offer that. Do you want some? How much do you want? You want it all? You want a little bit? That's your choice. How much pain can you handle? Had enough pain? You don't have to be that way anymore. So we have to offer what we've been given. Now look at those steps in there, and I said, how those all break down? Because I try to balance that off with everything. And the first step tells me who's wrong and what's wrong. I'm powerless. I lack the power over alcohol. We talked about that. My life is unmanageable. You see, if I go and I realize it in that treatment facility, that when I finally did an inventory and I saw the trouble and the drinking, and I put the alcohol along with the trouble, I was able to identify alcohol as a problem. And it was my choice. I was the one that tried to do that. I was the one in charge. When you got a losing record like that against booze, you know what they suggest? Fire the manager. Get rid of the manager. Your way's not working. Get out of the driver's seat, Larry. Get on the passenger side. Here, we're going to give you some newest directions, some new instructions. Try to use that. In that day that I realized that I was sitting in a coffee shop by myself. I had a cup of coffee, and I visualized that liquid drug alcohol that they had. I looked in there, and you know, as I looked in that coffee, I couldn't see any brain, I couldn't see any heart, and I couldn't see any feelings. It was just a liquid that I pretended to be alcohol. And yet when I put that liquid in my system, it whipped me time and time and time again. But I was the one that scheduled it. I was the one that got it started. I was the one that put it in. I put the little cup on the floor, and you can see I'm a giant compared to that cup like you are. And that cup whipped me every time. It whipped me every time. It was a small, powerful opponent, and I had a long losing streak, and I never knew that. When I finally found it out, you know what they told me? If you got an opponent that beats you every year, get him off the schedule. Don't play him. See, I can understand that. I don't know where you understand it, but I could understand that. Take it off the schedule. Now in Florida, there was an old timer, and he recognized I was a new person, sat me down, told me some of his story, New York, Bill Wilson, all that. He says, you know, kid, if you put 12 steps in your life, you don't have to take a drink ever again. He took a cup of coffee and he set it down on the table. He says, if you only put one step in your life, and he just stepped away one step. He says, you see, alcohol's one arm length away. Just one reach away of being a drunk again. He says, you put two steps in, it's right there. Three steps, you can still reach it. Then he marched off 12 steps. He put 12 steps in his life. He says, you can't reach out and grab a drink if you got 1,200 steps in your life. And if you do that, then you can't take a drink and you'll be all right. The way you want to take a drink is you got to take that stuff out of your life. You take those steps out and those meetings out, and all of a sudden you're an arm's length back. And I want to tell you something. I'm a visual person. I figured 12 steps in my life, okay? I'm going to get that sponsor. I'm going to get this home group. I'm going to build a barrier between me and the first drink. I'm going to have your stories in there. I got God in there. I got the big book in there. I'm going to build a barrier between me and that drink. And I've been doing that since the day I understood that. So that when things happen in life, hey, good, bad. I've heard people that have shared their stories about going through those experiences and not drinking. Then it was my turn. Barbara said to me the other day, I've never known anybody that's gone to so many funerals in their life. You know, when you got a lot of people in your life, things happen. And I look back on that, and I had started when my boss had hired me, and his boss had okayed it. They both died. And my mom died from lung cancer, cigarette smoker. Hide in the basement after she's lost her hair, taking the chemo, hide her cigarettes in the flower pot so she could get down in the basement to smoke her cigarettes so my dad wouldn't know it. And he killed her. The power of the addiction, she couldn't break it. And then my wife of 11 years, Marilyn, had 13 years in the program. She died at age 46 battling cancer. And then my sponsor died a year ago. And we've had a whole host of other people that have died. I have a friend in our area that lost 7 children in one accident several years ago. I heard his story. I heard how he got through it. He stayed sober. His life came together and had more kids. I didn't know when I was going to need that story. But he told how he survived through that without taking a drink. And like a friend of mine said, and I said earlier, all of a sudden it's my turn. It'll be your turns. Things happen in life. We lose some people because they got promoted and they got married. They had something good happen, and they couldn't handle that. They had a personality change, and all of a sudden we lose them because they don't handle the good stuff. I've been with national champions now. I've been with all kinds of neat things. The closest I've been to a drink, 1977, in the locker room, we just won the conference championship, and somebody comes in, and they got champagne or something. They must have been watching TV, you know. And I just work at a small college place. And next thing I know, somebody's pouring champagne over my head. It's coming down my face, around my nose, on the edge of my mouth. And the only thing I can tell you is I didn't even stick my tongue out. I didn't go get one of those. See? I didn't even get a sip or a lick. Didn't get a lick. And I walked in that shower, and I washed it off. And I walked over to one of my coworkers, and I said, you know, those guys shouldn't pour alcohol over their alcoholic coach. That's not good. And so, but I didn't take a drink. And I didn't get thirsty to take a drink. And whether we won or whether we lost, I wasn't going to drink. And whether they live or whether they pass on, I haven't had to take a drink. The strength to do that comes from this program and people like you, because where the strength came from, where the love came from, the unselfishness came from, the purity and the honesty comes from the examples. When I look at having been around people that express and show that, where did all the love and compassion come from? It came from people just like yourselves that didn't used to be that way. Having love from someone that never used to know love. Honesty from those that used to be dishonest. Purity from some of the most impure. And unselfishness from some of the selfish. People like us, maybe there's some others of us in this room besides me that fall into that category. And all of a sudden they show the opposite. All of a sudden in sobriety we have high standards to live up to because others have lived up to them before us. They show us a new way to live. They've given us the tools. We've got the toolbox. The question is, will you use them or not? That's what they ask. Larry, here's your tools. Here's all this stuff, the fundamentals, the basics. Will you use them? And I've been trying to pick them up every day and go to work with them in my life of sobriety. You have shown it to me. You have set the example, and you said, come along and join us. I've been included. Like somebody said, they were always the last one picked. And AA, we don't have that rule. Everybody's on the first team. Say, we don't have any all-pro or all-stars either. We just have the first team. Come join us. It says in there about practice, and I always think about the stadium. You know, I don't want to sit and watch the game of sobriety go on. I don't want to be like in Cleveland up in that dog section. Say, I want to be on the doggone field of play in the world of sobriety. And that's allowed today. We're allowed to do that. And we can be there, and we can be in our family, and our life, and our community, and our groups. And like in our group, we always say, you know, give the people at home a break. You know, take it home with them. We've been beating on them for years. Take it home to them. Would you talk to your wife like you talk to your sponsor? That's what we talk about, see? And so you showed me these steps. I look at steps 2, and I found out the insanity was to be sober, sane, and think that I could take a drink. Because they said that obsession has to be smashed. And I don't believe that I can do that today, so it's still there. And then they asked me to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood. And I have no trouble doing that, because I have a new understanding of God. You see, if my God is going to punish me every time I come home, then I'm not coming home. If I go to Keith's house and he whips me every day, pretty soon I'm not going to his house. It's just that simple. But I have a new understanding of God. I have a loving, caring God that's given me a gift and a grace. And I feel very close to him, and I feel that he's very close to me. I looked at those 10 commandments one time, and the day I did that, to the best of my knowledge, I wasn't breaking any, and I wasn't afraid of him either. If I don't break your rules, I don't have to be afraid of you. If I drive down your freeway at the right speed, I don't have to worry about the cop that's coming behind me or the one that's sitting in front of me, if I do that. If I pay my taxes, I don't worry about the IRS. If I don't cheat on my wife, I don't have to worry about that. It's a new way of life. You've given me the kind of the suggestions and the rules, the question, will I do it? And then all of a sudden, I got steps 4, 5, 6, or 7 to get me in order. And I did that. And 8 and 9 allows me to get life kind of in order with me and go out to those people so that I can be okay with them. And if they want to be okay with me, that's great. And then I got step 10 that I can kind of check on myself every day when I go to bed and I say, how did I do today? And I ask God to kind of go with me when I do that because I'm an easy grader. Okay? And I did this and I did this and I said, I got to make up for that. But if I don't take a drink, I'm a success by my standards. I can always repair the rest or try to. And then I get to that step 11 and it says sought. Sought to me means to seek. To seek. What is it I'm going to seek? Sought through prayer and meditation tells me how to do it. Prayer, meditation, talk and listen, whatever your definition. I just talk about communication with God. Put your own term on it. Sought through prayer and meditation to do what? Improve my conscious living contact with God as I understand. That's all I'm trying to do. So it's at level 8, I'm just going to try to take it to level 9. I'm going to try to improve on that. And then it says, and pray for the knowledge of His will for you. The knowledge, the know-how, the thing that I never knew about. And you're in His room and you're saying, this is what you do. The knowledge comes from your experience. The knowledge comes from your examples. Everybody's a great example. Want to show me what to do? They want to show me not what to do. I have a choice. Which one do I want to follow? And so I've got that. I've got the literature. I've got prayer. I've got all kinds of ways to get the knowledge, the know-how. But to put it into execution, I need the power. So I pray for the power. Where in the world is the power? I felt the power last night. I felt the power in every meeting. I got a room full here, and everyone's a power terminal. Daryl's got his experience, his strength, and his hope. Tina's got hers. Gene Keith's got... Everybody's in here has got their life, their experience, their strength. The power is here. Will I plug in? That's the question. Do I want what you got, Doug? If I do, I'll allow you to share it with me, and I will share it back. It's like the power and the light. The power's got to come in. The power's got to go out for the light to work. It's a two-way street. I come to give. I come to receive. And if I do that, then I'll get the benefit. So the power is right here, the power in prayer. There's all kinds of ways. This is a power terminal. There's a big generator in here. And I want to tell you something. I want all the juice I can get. I did as a user, and I do as a sober person. Because I don't know when I'm going to have to pull and flip that switch because I need something tonight, tomorrow. And I may have to go back a little later and get some more. Because my battery has a way of getting worn down. You know, if you're active and you do stuff, that'll happen. Look at how some of you guys are just ready to crash tonight. Some of you are ready to crash right now, too. But you just kind of have to put it on reserve and get through it, John. Get through it. So the power's here. The question is, how much do I want? And then what happens, it says, I have a spiritual experience. And that is not a complicated statement. It's in the back of the book under Appendix 2. And it has a title, a spiritual experience, spiritual awakening. And it means a personality change sufficient for the recovery from alcoholism in your life. That's what it says it is. And I have had that up to this moment, so I know it works up to now. Countdown last night tells us, like Gene and someone, they have a whole lot more. So it can work for a long time. We got a guy in our area, 53, 54 years sober, one of the original people. It works. That's what it tells us, because they work at it. They do the same things today that they did in the beginning that we're trying to learn to do now. They pass it on to us. And so it's there if we do the steps and what the program talks about. And then we have an opportunity. It says try to carry the message to others. Try. I can get so anonymous that I stop the message, for crying out loud. You mean I won't? I had a friend in the family said, your daughter can come over and play with my daughter, but don't have her mention about us being in the program because my daughter doesn't know it. He was anonymous to his daughter, for crying out loud. I don't understand that, but that's his house. He has the right to do that, and I support his right to do that. I don't have to agree with him, but I support the right to do it. And so, well, I take it into my community. Well, I take it wherever I go. And then there's an opportunity, and you start talking about alcoholism, drug addiction, that car, that raid. You talk with somebody at work, and the next thing, those that have trouble will be drawn to you. I haven't broken any tradition. I haven't even mentioned Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll talk about the subject, and they will be drawn to you if they have those difficulties in their life. Or at least they'll know that we seem to have some knowledge that somebody else doesn't, and when they need it or hurt bad enough, they might ask. And that's, to me, is trying to carry the message in all of our affairs. And then it says, and practice. Practice, huh? Practice, and I have to keep practicing because I never have it perfect. In the world of, what I'm in, we got two-a-day practices. Why do we do that? Because we finally have a special event, and then we want to perform well, and therefore we have to practice when they call our number, we can perform well. And then after that, we got to go back and practice some more because we didn't always get it perfect. And I find life being the same way. Life is the same to me. I got to practice it every day because I don't know what you've got coming up. Sometimes I do well and sometimes I don't do so well. And so all of a sudden I said, practice the principles. What principles? I ask the question, what principles, to myself, and I look back on the steps and the principles that I think I see says basically steps 2, 3, and 11, love God as you understand. Love yourself, steps 4, 5, 6, and 7. And then love others. I had heard that before, but I violated that. And if I'm willing to love my God with all my heart and all my might, as I understand it, I turned my will over to Him. I didn't turn it over to anybody else. I didn't turn it over to you. I didn't even turn it over to me. I didn't turn it over to Barb. I turned it over to Him this morning. You know, I kind of, like they say, volunteered for service. What is it you have me to do? And I hope that I can do it. Give me the power if I need it. If I can get that right, if I have love for Him, and then I look around and I feel that love for myself, I can look in the mirror today and find a friend different than looking at it and you want to crush the image, blow the brains out of it. I don't feel like that today. And then I realize that I was given the opportunity to change. I was guided to sobriety, guided to the program, and guided to the people. I didn't know that myself. I was brought to it. It was given to me as a gift, a grace. Do I have appreciation and gratitude for? If I do, it'll show in my actions. And then once I'm there, I look around and here's a question. Can I love others the way I have been loved? I wasn't lovable, but I was given the opportunity to change. Will I do that for other people? Sometimes I'm not as gracious to others that I've been given the grace myself. I fall short of that. I get judgmental. I'm liable to take your inventory for you. And I look at it, what right do I have to do that? And sometimes, of course, it's necessary, working with the new people. But I'm liable to do that with my wife and the guys I work with. That just tells me I'm human and I got more work to do. I don't have it right yet. So maybe I better keep coming back. And if I keep coming back, maybe I'll find out how to better do that. It's been given to me. What am I going to do with the gift? Am I going to keep it to myself or am I going to pass it on? I try to pass it on to you today the best I know how at this moment. I try to talk with my heart and hopefully it'll reach your heart. What you heard and what I said may not be the same thing. I haven't the faintest idea. But your theme is, you know, we are the future. I don't know how many of you read the 24-hour book. I'm sure you didn't read it, Paul, before you made the plan and the theme. But on the 19th, it talks about the past. On the 20th, it talks about the future. And on the 21st of March, it talks about the future is now. Today. We live today. I read that this morning. I got chills. Actually, I read it on the 19th, and because I read ahead, I got chills. And I thought I might forget to mention it. So it's been on my mind. And I look at the future here, and I looked at it last night, and I looked at it Friday. I looked at it every chance I get. And you talk about a beautiful example. How are we doing today? How's our future? I want to tell you something. Where's Paul? Paul, are you still here? Where's Paul? There's Paul over there. you know, in his life, he went to make the calls, to coordinate, to help us get out of here. I want you to know that I appreciate that, because by being here, I have had a chance to grow, and you're one of the causes. You're one of the future, and I thank you. And old Mike and John, guys came out to meet us at the airport. I've seen these guys two times in my life, Keith. And I feel a love. Like Mike said the other day, John is my brother. I want to tell you something, that's not biker talk. That's biblical talk. If you want to check the book of that, read the book. They talk about the brothers and the sisters. You want to talk about the love? When I look at a room like this, it says in the big book, we are a group of people who would have never mixed. There are some of you folks that may not want to drink with me, and I might not want to drink with you. And I've never been on a bike. It scares me. Okay? But in these rooms, we have a common opponent, and they give us a common solution. And all of a sudden, with Mike and John and Keith and several others here, I can feel a love in my system that I never used to feel for other people. Now that has been given. And so we say, how is the future? The future is this moment. The future was in little Jonathan and Jimmy last night, and Sarah and Linda, and their moms and their dads. And all the folks that were here last night with wherever they came from and whatever it was they were doing, they are the future because they are the now. They are the moment. Today, it's us. The most important people are the ones right here in this room. That when we leave these rooms, we take out of it something to help the one that hasn't been here yet. And if we will help them here, then they become the future for tomorrow. I've been to like a lot of funerals, and we have a lot of old-timers dying. And all of a sudden, I can sit in a meeting and somebody says, well, Larry, what do you think? Wow. You know, somebody has been driving me around for years, and they finally said, Larry, your turn to drive. Somebody else gets to ride along. That's a big responsibility. Can I handle it? Do I want to handle it? You've shown it. You've given it to me. Well, I love the others enough to give it to them. This morning, I say, I can. I'm willing. I will. I love you for it. Thanks for having us.